never know what you're going to get.
If you're on the way home from work, pumping iron at the gym, or just chilling at home, Soul Rebel Radio is here to keep you company. Tune in every Friday at 7 p.m.
That's right, 90.7 KPFK, Soul Rebel Radio.
Afternoon, friends. This is Maria Hall, and I am here at the Lawyers Guild show on KPFK 90.7 FM. Sadly, my co-host Jim Lafferty is out of town, but he'll be back soon. And in the meantime, I've got a great show lined up for you today. In our first half hour, we'll be diving into one of my favorite subjects, the news, laws, and policies about housing in LA. In particular, about how to survive as a renter. We'll be speaking with attorney John Noddy in just a few minutes, who devotes his life to getting down there in the trenches at free legal clinics and in the courtroom in a quest to get justice for tenants. So we'll be talking about all the updates in housing law. And then in our second half hour at 3:30, we'll be talking about another one of my favorite subjects, which is the right to control your own artistic and creative works from trademark and copyright infringement. But alas, how that also interplays with First Amendment protections of parody and political satire. And it's all getting really muddy with artificial intelligence now jumping into the ring. We'll be joined by attorney Eric Seha for that segment, a lawyer who's also very creative and has a keen sense of satire. So we'll be going over cases that range from Frida Kahlo to Trader Joe's to, of course, Tupac. So without further ado, though, let's jump right into our first segment. With all the polarization out there, I think one thing is indisputable, and that is that Los Angeles is experiencing an affordable housing crisis. According to the 2023 Greater Los Angeles Homeless Count, there are over 75,000 unhoused people out there in LA County. During the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, the eviction courts at least slowed down a little bit and were even halted for a brief time. But that's in the rearview mirror now. If you go down to the courthouse, you'll see the eviction courts are full. And any tenants who are living on the financial edge are back to the stress and confusion of trying to figure out what their rights are, and even more importantly, how to access legal services and exercise those rights. So I'm so happy to have with us here today someone who counsels people every day about how to stand up for their rights so they can achieve justice for themselves, their families, and their communities. He is attorney John Noddy. John holds both a law degree and an MBA, and he's a CPA to boot. He founded his law firm, My Tenant Lawyer, so he could exclusively represent tenants, never landlords. To date, he's successfully recovered and defended millions of dollars for tenants. And in addition, as I mentioned, he's a tireless volunteer, rolling up his sleeves to help people whether or not they can afford a lawyer, and someone who collaborates and supports the great grassroots organizations and tenants unions on the ground and in the courtroom. Attorney John Noddy, welcome to the Lawyers Guild show.
Hey, Maria. Thanks for having me.
Yes, yes. So please, John, tell our listeners, in addition to the legal work that you do representing tenants in court, you also regularly volunteer at free legal clinics. In sort of broad strokes, what kinds of issues are tenants coming into the clinics with?
I think there are three main areas that we're dealing with the most. Number one is bad living conditions. Number two is tenant harassment. And number three, which is much broader, lack of information or bad information. So to tackle the first issue, you know, being bad living conditions, rather than go through the nuts and bolts of law that could maybe be boring for a lot of people, I'm thinking what we could possibly do is just start talking how to give them practical advice on how to solve the problem rather than just know about it. So in Los Angeles and throughout California, everybody has a right to a habitable home as a renter. Doesn't matter if your landlord doesn't want to give it to you, and it doesn't matter if your lease says we're not responsible for the living conditions of the unit. It doesn't work. So if you are experiencing bad living conditions in the city of Los Angeles, of course, it's always great to first put something in writing to your landlord, you know, because working things out politically without involving lawyers in the city are always the best solutions. But if the landlord doesn't want to make the repairs that you need, there are three agencies that you can contact for the specific types of problems. And we'll just go through that real fast. So the first agency is the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health, and they are going to be the agency dealing with mold and infestation. Do not call the other agencies for mold and infestation. Only the health department, county health department, is going to deal with this. But there's a trick. They don't tell you that you have to actually file two complaints before you'll get an inspection. So what happens is you first file a complaint. So you can do that online. You can just go to the county public health department, file a complaint, and they will send out a letter to you and to the landlord. It'll be the same letter, and it's called a courtesy notice to abate. And on that letter, there's going to be a date by which the landlord has to make the repairs. If the repairs aren't made, then you file your second complaint. That will trigger your inspection, right? And you only get one chance at this as a practical matter. So if there's infestation, you better leave out some sticky traps. You better be able to show the inspector what's going on, or else if they don't see it, they're going to close your case and they're not going to come back. They're not going to look at your phone. No, they're not going to look at your videos, no matter how much you swear that it's there. They have to actually see it for themselves to issue a citation in order for the landlord to make the repairs. The other agency is SoCal Gas. So if you have a gas stove, gas heater, then it's going to be SoCal Gas that's going to come out if the gas isn't working or the appliance is connected or working. And they will come fast, usually within 24 hours. Why? Well, because gas can be very dangerous if there's a leak. And the third agency in the city of Los Angeles is going to be the Los Angeles Housing Department. So anything not covered by the health department or SoCal Gas is going to fall within the purview of the Los Angeles Housing Department. And just the same, you can go right online. You just fill out the drop-down menu, name, address, what's going on, and they will schedule an inspection for you. And if they agree with what you say is going on, they will issue citations and orders to the landlord. Now, why is this important? Because if they have to keep coming back, if the landlord's not making the repairs, they will issue fines against the landlord for the inspection fees. So there's leverage there. In addition to that, if the landlord keeps going down this road of not making repairs, this landlord could end up in the REAP program, which is a special bad place for landlords to be in with the city. It's an administrative action, and we won't go into all the details and punishments for the landlords. But what we're going to focus on right now is just the practical ways that tenants can get these repairs made. So just to recap, health department for mold and infestation, SoCal Gas for the gas problems, and Los Angeles Housing Department for everything else. So that's the number one that we're seeing with, you know, people having problems. Number two is harassment. It's important.
Oh, can I ask you a quick follow-up before we leave the subject of the first one of the living conditions? When you say infestation, can you describe what that means? When does it rise to the level of something that the health department might care about?
The real life answer to that question is it's going to depend on the inspector who comes out. But typically speaking, if they see live or dead cockroaches, bed bugs, if they see a mold-like substance on the wall, they're going to issue a citation. In fact, they will even issue citations for rodent infestation if they see droppings, not even necessarily because it's evidence of an infestation. So I haven't seen a situation where an inspector said that you don't have enough cockroaches here. I mean, generally speaking, if they see something, there's going to be a citation. And thankfully for that we're not arguing about the definition of infestation.
Yeah, gross. But yes, go right? on. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. And in addition to the bad living conditions, is harassment. So the thing that we're seeing the most on the harassment side is tenants not knowing what harassment is or isn't. It's not the same as someone walking down the street next to you who's being annoying. That's not what harassment is in the landlord-tenant context. So for people that want to know exactly what harassment is, they can Google Los Angeles anti-harassment ordinance. And if when the city law will actually come up, and there's a specific list of things that are harassment. So if it doesn't fall within the list of what's going on with you, it's not considered harassment under the ordinance. Even it might be really annoying. And unfortunately, being a really bad person is not against the law. So just because your landlord is mean doesn't necessarily mean it's harassment. It could be something else, but it might not be harassment. So it's important that if you're trying to build a case to show that your landlord is harassing you, to be familiar with the list so that when you're gathering all these examples, you can put them in each little box of, okay, the landlord threatened to call immigration on me. Well, that's harassment. You can't do that. Or the landlord is refusing to take my rent payments. That's harassment. So it's important to know the lay of the land when you're dealing with harassment cases. And then number three, and it's very common at clinics and even people that call the office, is Google can sometimes be your best friend and it can be your worst friend. Because Google is not responsible to populate the most up-to-date, accurate information when you start dropping search terms into the search engine. So what that means is that you can pull up an article that was never correct in the first place, or it could have been correct, but it's not anymore. Believe it or not, there are, some people still think that the COVID moratorium is still going on, and it's not, because they're pulling up old, or they're on chat boards, and they're getting their legal advice from someone they don't even know who they are, or they're getting legal advice from their uncle or their friend that used to know someone that worked at a law office 10 years ago. It's unbelievable, the amount of sources of information that are available to people anymore. So to avoid all of that, and I think that's a great segue into all of the resources that are available to get up-to-date, accurate information.
Yes, please. So, I would love to hear your opinion about what are, just kind of the lay of the land in Los Angeles. We are lucky, I will say, that it's not perfect here, but we are lucky. We have some amazing organizations and amazing people who are really down to help. So please, give us a little landscape about what are some of the trustworthy sources out there and how can people go about it, even if they can't afford to hire an attorney, as most of us would not be able to even hire ourselves probably. So how do people kind of wade through this?
So I'm going to go slowly. So in case anyone is out there writing this down.
Right.
So if you actually receive a lawsuit for eviction, there is a program called Stay Housed LA, which is receiving lots and lots of grant money or issuing lots of grant money to legal nonprofits to provide free eviction defense. So that was going to be your first line of defense to an eviction, is signing yourself up, but they don't get involved until you actually are served the lawsuit. So if you get a notice or your landlord's being annoying, the scope of Stay Housed LA just isn't quite there to be the catch-all for legal advice. So outside of the actual lawsuit context and people that just want to know, hey, what's going on? I need advice. So here are a list of clinics through nonprofits that are available. So Coalition for Economic Survival is a fantastic legal clinic, and it happens every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. on Zoom. So you don't have to get in your car. You can just make your coffee, jump on Zoom, and sometimes there are 20 people there, sometimes there are 70. But as they say, if you stick with us, we'll stick with you. You will get seen. It's one-on-one consultations, so Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Another available option is Eviction Defense Network, and they actually have them Monday through Saturday. So Eviction Defense Network has videos, and they've been made by the executive producer or executive director over there, Elena Pop, who's one of the most famous tenants' rights lawyers in all of California. So Eviction Defense Network is Monday through Saturday, and you can go on their webpage and you can look at the schedule, and you can, I believe they may even have the videos uploaded to the webpage. If you're looking for something that's in person, there's a nonprofit called SAGE, S-A-J-E, and they have a legal clinic walk-in on the first and third Tuesdays of each month from 4 to 6 p.m., and you can go on their webpage. You can sign yourself up, and you bring your documents, and you can sit down with someone who will help walk you through whatever you're dealing with. And ACE is another nonprofit that has one on Thursday nights at 5:30 on Zoom. And I think that what I'm really getting at is there are so many resources available for people that there's no reason to feel alone. Organizations that, even if they're not providing lawyers, they're providing tenant organizing, tenant support, emergency response teams for people that, for example, get locked out of their apartment at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday by the landlord. They will send a group of people down there. They will call the media. They will call the police, and they will come, and you will not be standing on the sidewalk alone, but you have to join the organizations. So SAGE and ACE are great for that. And of course, there is a tenants and legal clinic at the law library, and I think Maria is very familiar with that one. And I think you can call the library and you can schedule, and they will walk you through that process. And last but not least, for people that are experiencing that have a disability, the Housing Rights Center has a department that specifically assists people with a disability. And the reason that's important is because those issues often need to be expedited. And that includes people that are being denied reasonable accommodations, or people that just need, someone to get in touch with the landlord, either, via letter or something, because the disability is making it extra difficult for them to assert their rights as a tenant. So that's, there are more, but I don't want to, bore everyone sitting here listing clinics. But the point is that if you Google Tenants Rights Clinic Los Angeles, you could probably come up with a lot of these clinics. And if you were writing them down, then you have the information that you need to get in touch with someone who can help you. Because trying to just call around the law offices, hoping a lawyer is going to pick up the phone and spend 40 minutes, it's very unlikely. But the nonprofits are fantastic. And believe it or not, they actually care. And sometimes that can be the most important thing, is for someone to actually care that you're going through this problem, not just to give you some academic answer of what your rights are.
Yes, absolutely. And I have seen the emergency protections in action, where somebody came when somebody was locked out and they got it handled. So yes, I will vouch for that. And I think once you get in with one organization, it's a very small world. So it's very interconnected. So even if you just, you don't have to call 20 organizations, you get in there, just, make the first step. That is wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And let's talk a little bit about the legal protections for tenants in California before we were talking more narrowly about city and county of Los Angeles, which they have their own protections, but then even the baseline California protections right before COVID, it was big news, but then it got eclipsed by the pandemic, which is the Tenant Protection Act, which required landlords to have just cause, quote unquote, to evict most tenants in the state. And just last month, as of April 1st, Maria Elena Durazo had sponsored a bill, SB 567, that made the protections even a little better. So just very briefly, I know this could be a whole hour, but what does just cause eviction actually mean? And, what should people be concerned about or aware of?
Just cause eviction, for people that are dealing with this problem, you can look at it very much in the same way as that we just looked at harassment, and that it can only be just cause if it's on the very specific list of things that are considered just cause. So don't use the everyday language of just cause, meaning good reason. That doesn't cut it. If it's not on the list, it doesn't count. So that means that if your landlord says, I'm selling the building, you have to move. Although you might think it feels like a good reason, that's not actually just cause. So do not self-evict because your landlord has a business interest in making extra profit from selling the property. Consult with a lawyer. You know, if you want to consider being bought out, that's something different. Once you, what we call self-evict, once you move out and you do it voluntarily, there's not a whole lot that can be done. And if you were owed relocation fees, like, you know, whether it's, you know, the city or county, you're out, you don't get relocation after you have already relocated yourself. You also will lose the chance to negotiate a buyout if you want. So, people can pull up just cause evictions. But interesting is that housing, the analysis is actually backwards from a lot of ways that we look at law, because in California, so cities are allowed to have greater protections for their residents than what the state allows, which is why in LA we have rent control. So, which is one of the ways that people end up with bad information is because they start Googling things and they say, oh, I'm on a month to month because California, but actually you're in a Los Angeles rent stabilized, you know, i.e. rent controlled apartment. You are essentially on a month to month at your discretion, meaning as long as you're not doing anything wrong and you're paying your rent, the landlord, generally speaking, is stuck with you. It is not a month to month where they can serve you with 30-day note in the city of Los Angeles and in other cities like West Hollywood and Santa Monica, in places that have decided that they want residents to be protected more than what the state of California is doing, which is why sometimes, like I said, Google can be your worst enemy, because if you start looking at California law, you could end up with the wrong answer relating to your particular apartment, even though it could be the right answer if you lived, you know, in a different part of California. Definitely don't consider, in the most common way that people are self-evicting under this just cause is they think that the landlord selling the property means they got to go. And that's not true.
Yeah.
So, I see that too. You know, if you do get a notice, from your landlord saying, I'm selling the property, the first thing that you should do is A, tell everyone you live with, we're not moving out yet. We're gonna go to a legal clinic, whether it's gonna be at Sage or Ace or Coalition, and we're gonna find out what our rights are so that we can protect ourselves in the best way possible.
Yes, and I should remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is KPFK 90.7 FM, the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall, and I'm speaking with attorney John Noddy. So if you're wondering, you're hearing all this great information, and you know, sometimes I get so into what you're saying that I forget to tell people who you are. So let's move on. And our time is going really fast, of course, as it always does. So let's talk about a high profile case in the news right now. And that is Barrington Plaza. Last May, the owner, Douglas Emmett, served eviction notices to 577 tenants, initiating one of the largest mass evictions of rent-controlled tenants in LA's history. Can you tell us, we've seen it on the headlines, but what actually are the legal issues here? What's the landlord's position? And how are the tenants banding together?
Well, actually, interestingly, going full circle about this, the tenants banded together, are hundreds of them, because they all came to a Saturday clinic at Coalition for Economic Survival. And Coalition for Economic Survival, along with Larry Gross, organized these tenants and found them representation. And there aren't actually a lot of issues at play. It really comes down to the landlord wanting to remove these rental units from the rental market. So the fancy way of saying that for the lawyers out there is the Ellis Act. And it allows landlords to say, hey, I don't want to rent this out anymore. I want to do something else with it. Could be, you know, condos. I'm going to knock it down and build myself a house, or, you know, what have you. But in this situation, there had been a number of fires in these towers. And the landlord is saying, hey, it's going to take us 3 years to put adequate sprinklers in these buildings in order to make them safe enough. So you all have to go. And the tenant's position is, well, wait, The ALICE Act requires that you permanently remove these units from the rental market, not that you just want to restring the sprinklers and get 500 some odd tenants that are still left out of their rent controlled units. Because, you know, we're not just talking about, you know, people that are doing great in life who, you know, could just simply pick up and move down the street into West LA. There are a lot of people that are long-term tenants who their rent is not replaceable. And for those people listening that are in a rent controlled unit, you probably know what irreplaceable rent is. If you had to move, you probably wouldn't be in Los Angeles anymore. So the displacement would be enormous. And if it were to be allowed, and if the judge decides that these units can be re-rented after the sprinklers are, Douglas Emmett could possibly be looking at a significant ability to increase the rents. And so it's a big issue because it is merging the ALICE Act with the substantial renovation type eviction that we're seeing. We call them rent evictions, which is a combination of renovation and evictions. And so landlords are allowed to try to get rid of tenants for what we call substantial renovations. But in this situation, they're going at it via the ALICE Act. So my understanding is that the court is going to be briefed one more time as to what permanent means or the definition of permanent in this context. So it appears that and there's no jury in this case. So it appears the judge is really wanting to focus in on this special word and, you know, whether permanent is permanent or permanent just means for a long period of time. And I don't really have a guess as to how this is going to go. I did go watch the trial one afternoon. It was interesting. But of course, I'm far too busy to be sitting watching trials all day. Yeah. So it's a big case, and the lawyer handling it, Frank Campbell, is fantastic. She does a lot of volunteering as well. And so, you know, she was part of the organizing effort to make sure that these tenants are represented.
Yes, hear, hear, take Fran Campbell. And after the trial, I'll have her on. Hopefully it'll be a big success to talk about. But yeah, it's heavy lifting out there. So we are running out of time. I wanted to make sure that I got through anything that you wanted to talk with. So why don't you tell us, you know, what are your sort of final thoughts? But don't forget also at the end, we need to know how to find you.
Sure. Since we were talking about, potential buyouts, sometimes they're called cash for keys. I just want everyone to know that buyouts are negotiations between you and your landlord. Don't let the landlord convince you that the grid published by the housing department for relocation is all the amounts of money they have to pay you to force you out. Those amounts are for very specific types of evictions like the ALICE Act, not for you just to voluntarily give up a unit that you've been living in under rent control for the last 15 or so years. So though the nonprofits and the clinics would be a great resource to find out, hey, is this going to, you know, do I qualify for this relocation amount or can I negotiate more? Always try to negotiate more if you decide that you can just decide, I don't want to move out at all. But for people, if they want to find me, my webpage is very easy. It's called mytenantlawyer.com. And the phone number is 8444-TENANT.
Wonderful. And can you also tell us just a rundown again of the organizations that you are saying, the clinics?
Yes. So if you have an eviction lawsuit, stay housed LA. If you want to come to a clinic on Saturday morning at 10 a.m., it is Coalition for Economic Survival. If you want to watch videos Monday through Saturday in the evenings, you can go to Eviction Defense Network and you can be brought in and you will watch videos as a group. SAGE. SAGE has in-person clinics the first and third Tuesdays of every month from 4 to 6 p.m. And ACCE, which is ACE, has a clinic on Zoom every Thursday at 5:30. And of course, the Law Library. You can contact the Law Library right downtown. And if you do go to the Law Library, you can probably get to meet Maria Hall.
Probably if it's very crowded, though, so I might be waving from afar. But John Noddy, thank you so much. That is so much information. It's hard for any of us to keep it straight. And it really is a public service, even that you can recite them in 1 minute. That is a huge public service because there's just so much out there. We are fortunate to have wonderful people, you know, attorneys like John Noddy and other, you know, organizers and tenants unions and really fabulous people here in Los Angeles, many different languages as well. So don't be shy. It really does take that first step to stand up for your rights. So thank you again, John Noddy. I definitely want to have you back again. So have a great one. And thanks for being with us.
Well, you have my cell. Just send me a text. I'll show up. Thanks for having
All right.
Me.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Well, again, this is Maria Hall. This is the Lawyers Guild Show, KPFK 90.7 FM. We are going to pause very briefly for a station ID break, and then we'll be back.
Hello, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
We are back. I'm Maria Hall. It's such a pleasure to be here with you all today on KPFK 90.7 FM. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. And like the song says, we are all about standing up for your rights here. And in our next segment, we are talking about standing up for your rights to create art and inventions. In short, your right to keep your intellectual property. When artists don't know their rights and get hoodwinked into bad contracts, they can earn almost nothing while someone else handsomely profits for their ideas. But on the other hand, our First Amendment freedom of speech and expression also gives some room there for parody, you know, being deliberately sarcastic or exaggerating for comic effect, or often for serious political satire as a commentary on society. And these lines can be as clear as mud, especially when you start throwing artificial intelligence into the mix. But that's what makes the issues so interesting. And in fact, we're going to delve into a few intriguing cases that are making headlines right now with our guest. Meet attorney Eric Ceja, the founder of the Ceja Firm, located in Long Beach, California, the LBC. Eric is an esteemed attorney specializing in trademark and copyright law, catering to a diverse clientele comprising artists, streetwear brands, lawyers, and other business owners. Drawing from this genuine passion for the arts and creativity, and with a keen understanding of the intricacies of intellectual property law, Eric is dedicated to protecting the creative endeavors and commercial interests of his clients by safeguarding their artistic expressions, securing trademark and copyright registrations, and navigating complex legal issues on their behalf. Welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show, Eric Ceja.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you for having me on this great show and this beautiful afternoon.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And of course, I always admire, you should check out Eric's website because you can see some of the artwork that he's even done himself along with his clients. But let's start just jumping into a recent lawsuit. You know, who knew that if you write trademark lawsuits in the news, you come up with all kinds of really fun stories. So one has to do with labor unions and Trader Joe's. So this recent lawsuit was filed by Trader Joe's against an independent labor union that's been organizing its workers called Trader Joe's United. And of course, on the Lawyers Guild Show, anytime we hear about an employer coming down against a union, we're going to start thinking, what about the First Amendment rights protecting organizing? So Eric, tell us about this case. Why did Trader Joe's bring this suit? What are the legal issues and what happened?
Sure. So, well, I can tell you what Trader Joe is saying as to why they brought this lawsuit. They're saying that they brought this lawsuit against its own employee union, Trader Joe's United, for causes of action for both federal and state trademark infringement, unfair competition, and trademark dilution. Trader Joe says that it brought the lawsuit because the employee union is selling clothing, mugs, reusable tote bags that use Trader Joe's registered and common law trademarks in a way that's likely to cause consumer confusion. The products are available on TraderJoe'sUnited.org, so the audience can take a look at those while we're talking about that. And so the marks at issue are Trader Joe's literal marks, which protect the words, and the stylized mark, which protect the logos and also protect their typeface, the colored red, and the concentric circle design. Interestingly, in this matter and in this case, Trader Joe's is not alleging unauthorized use of its name, Trader Joe's. It's basically alleging unauthorized use of its logos, which ended up hurting them in this case, as we'll find out, because the court really focused its efforts and its analysis on the logo. And so Trader Joe's United, right, is an employee union that was created to unionize Trader Joe locations across the United States. And so Trader Joe's is saying there's trademark infringement. Trader Joe's United is saying this lawsuit was actually filed in retaliation for those unionization efforts. Specifically, they're saying that Trader Joe's is weaponizing the federal courts in retaliation against workers who have unionized and labor unions that assisted those workers' efforts. So the union shot back by filing a motion to dismiss their complaint under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 12b6, which is basically saying that we have to dismiss the court has to dismiss this complaint because there's a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And so in its motion, the Trader Joe's union basically pointed out the fact that this lawsuit was filed 6 days after the National Labor Relations Board issued a consolidated complaint against Trader Joe's for unlawful conduct during its election in violation of the National Labor Relations Act. These violations include discriminatory enforcement, threats, overbroad rules, retaliation against and interrogation of employees who supported the union, and providing false and misleading information about the union. It also charged Trader Joe with interfering with, restraining, and coercing employees in the exercise of the rights guaranteed under the act, and basically discouraging membership in a labor organization. So the United States District Court listened to the motion and granted the motion and set forth an order dismissing the complaint. And as a preliminary matter, the court noted that this action, this trademark infringement action, is undoubtedly related to the existing labor dispute. And it strains credulity to believe that the present lawsuit would have been filed absent the ongoing organizing efforts that Trader Joe's employees have mounted successfully against Trader Joe in multiple locations across the United States. Further, the court dismissed the request for injunctive relief under the Norris LaGuardia Act, which was passed by Congress precisely to extract courts from the unfortunate business of issuing ostensibly business-related injunctions in pending labor disputes. So, but the Lanham Act, which is basically the Trademark Act, doesn't have that distinction with regards to trademark law. So the court had to look a little bit further and had to actually go through the likelihood of confusion factors to determine whether there was any actual trademark infringement. And so, you know, the Trademark Act protects trademarks in the United States, right? This is, it protects the trademark registration, It extends to words, brands, names, symbols, slogans, and it basically is the framework around infringement actions. And within that framework, in order for a plaintiff to prove trademark infringement, they have to show that they own a valid trademark. They have to show that the defendant is using the trademark without the plaintiff's authorization. And the most important part, that the defendant's use of the trademark is likely to confuse consumers as to the origin of the source of the goods. In California, the courts follow what's known as the sleek craft factors. And using these factors, the court's going to look at the strength of the mark, the relatedness of the goods, similarity of the marks, any evidence of actual confusion, marketing channels, and a couple other factors. So when the court looked at these logos, they found that the logos used by the union are in a different font. They don't utilize Trader Joe's distinctive fruit basket design, and they apply concentric rings of different proportions and are applied to products that no reasonable consumer could confuse as coming from Trader Joe's itself. So the court ended up dismissing the complaint in its entirety.
Wow, amazing. So in other words, did the court comment on that it was likely retaliatory for organizing?
Yes. And they went as far as it can go without saying that it was meritless, right? That it could have been dismissed under Rule 11. But like they said, as a preliminary factor, they did say that it was related to this, to the ongoing labor disputes, but, they had to go through the factors to actually dismiss it through the motion, because the Trademark Act is silent as to, you know, this dispute between labor and trademarks and employers using trademark infringement actions. But this previous act, the LaGuardia Act, was passed in order to avoid these types of issues, because that's what employers used to do. Employers would go and seek preliminary injunction against their employees whenever they try to unionize or whenever they did something that the employer didn't want them to do. So right. The Congress got involved and put out made this act in order to stop that. But at that point, they really didn't consider whether or not trademark or trademark infringement could be used in that regard. And Trader Joe used trademark law to try to stop them and try to strike back. Essentially to try to stop them through preliminary injunctive or injunctive relief, but also through getting a ruling to say that their use of the logo was infringing on Trader Joe's trademarks.
Wow. Yeah, and probably because I doubt the union has the fancy lawyers that Trader Joe's has. But, I mean, it was a creative argument by Trader Joe's. But, you know, it really sounded like an attempt at union busting, which it sounds like the court was able to find a way to get that through. So now, sort of related, but maybe one that troubles me more because of the ruling in this next case. A federal court deciding that a parody of a Vans shoe created by Mischief, which is an art collective, and that's capital MSCHF, an art collective with works displayed in museums, galleries, and art shows. A court ruled that it infringed on Vans' trademark. First, tell us a little bit about this subculture of artists, because I know you represent some of them, who kind of riff on contemporary society like Mischief and the legal issues involving their artistic expression.
Sure. So, you know, the subculture of artists who riff on society like Mischief, it's often characterized by a mix of satire, irony, and social commentary. Artists use their art, not all of them, but many of them use their art to provoke thought, to challenge norms, and, you know, sometimes to incite controversy. And Mischief is not one to pull any punches when it comes in that regard. Mischief and other artists, you know, they draw inspiration from current events, pop culture, technology, social media, and pre-existing works in order to comment, to critique, to reflect their thoughts on what modern society is. So Mischief, they've gained notoriety throughout their existence. They were the ones that were behind the Satan Shoes, which collaborated with Lil Nas X, and which actually included, you know, real blood from the artists in the soles of the shoes. And these were done off on Nikes. And Nike actually did file a lawsuit, but they were able to resolve that and settle that outside of court. Unfortunately, with Vans, that was not the case. And so the artistic expression and existing trademark law sometimes lands these artists and creators in legal hot water. So especially when it involves infringement.
So, yeah, tell us a little bit about this case. And it doesn't, it's nothing gross like the blood. I mean, it seemed pretty harmless, but tell us about this case with the shoe.
Yeah, so basically Vans, right, is a well-known footwear brand, and they have a style of shoe known as the Old School, and it is undoubtedly one of the most famous type of shoes ever created, not only in skating culture, but also just in streetwear culture and everyday culture. And so what Mischief did essentially is they ran that shoe through a lens or a filter that made it wavy. And I welcome the users to look up the wavy baby, which is what they call the shoes, just to get a sense of what these shoes look like. But it is a distorted version of these shoes. It's a modified version where they're not using the Vans trademark. They're using what they call the wavy baby, or even just wavy as its trademark. And the shoes literally look, they look like cartoon shoes. They look like they are distorted and wavy, almost look very hard to walk in. But they're very interesting. And, you know, Mischief did put out an official statement on why they created, and that's something that Mischief does. Mischief normally does bring out and actually explain the reason why they're doing things. And one of the reasons that they had, basically this commentary, or why they brought out the wavy baby, is that shoes are always stealing from each other, right? One company will come out with a shoe, then another company will come out with a different color, a different sole, a different top, a different bottom. And it's kind of this like never-ending cycle of artists and not artists, but of brands basically stealing from each other, right? So this was their commentary. This was their critique on the shoes and this endless cycle. But of course, Vans did not take it that way. And Vans went after them and filed a trademark infringement matter. And basically, Mischief argued that because these were artistic expressions, that the level of scrutiny should be higher, right? It should be based off First Amendment rights, and something known. They basically argued that they should be using the Rogers test because it had to do with artistic expression. The court unfortunately disagreed with that. And the court disagreed because they said that, yes, although this may be a parody, this parody trademark is being used as its own trademark. And it drew that distinction between parodies who are just parodies for parody's sake compared to parodies that are actually their own trademarks and being used as their own trademarks. And for that reason, they said that the First Amendment does not protect that use. And this actually came down the line with a different case between Jack Daniels and Bad Spaniels. Cocker Spaniels, Bad Spaniels, which was dog toys. They were dog toys that looked like Jack Daniels bottles, but said Bad Spaniels, and which were obviously a parody of Jack Daniels. But because Bad Spaniels itself was a trademark, the court refused to follow the Rogers test and basically found that there was infringement in that action too. So the court used the reasoning in the Jack Daniels versus Bad Spaniels case to come up with this decision to say mischief, we're sorry, but this is infringement.
Wow. Well, yeah. And I don't know if they'll be appealing. Do you have any idea on that?
Well, that's that was that they lost that appeal. You know, there was a preliminary injunction, and that's and then Mischief filed the appeal, and that's the ruling that came down, was that they lost that appeal.
Okay. Well, I do want we are running out of time. Just to remind listeners, this is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall, and I am here speaking with attorney Eric Ceja. And I do want to, before we run out of time here, I do want to get to the topic of deep fakes, because this to me is one of the most interesting issues in intellectual property right now. Tennessee passed a law actually called the Elvis Act, which was to prevent artists' personalities from being copied on AI without their permission. And this was recently really big news. It still is, actually, with the AI-generated voice of the late rapper Tupac Shakur. In very broad strokes, give us a rundown of that dispute, the Drake versus the world and dispute, and how this came about with the AI-generated voice of Tupac. Tell us about the legal rights at play here.
Sure. So Tennessee is making noise because they basically became the first state to protect musicians and other artists against AI. Now, the legal framework is now known as the Elvis Act. And the Elvis Act basically stands for Ensuring Likeness, Voice, and Image Security Act. And it replaces the Tennessee's old right of publicity law. So under the old law, it protected an artist's name, its photograph, or its likeness. But the new law includes AI specific protections. So once the law takes effect on July 1st, people will be prohibited from using AI to mimic an artist's voice without their permission. Now, this recently came to play in California. As I'm sure all your listeners know, between this huge rap beef between Drake and Kendrick Lamar, and when Drake dropped a diss record entitled "Tailor Made Freestyle," which included an AI depiction of Tupac, actually, rapping lyrics and speaking to Kendrick Lamar. And what happened there is the estate of Tupac did not take kindly to that and issued a cease and desist under California law, which under California law, we have right of publicity. So although we don't have an AI specific law yet, and I say yet because just like Tennessee, California is also right now at this point considering an AI specific law to again replace the old right of publicity law. Even through the existing right of publicity law, which does cover voice, they were able to get Drake to promptly remove the tailor-made freestyle from all streaming platforms.
Wow, I do know a lot of artists here. I mean, we're here in Hollywood, of course, and there's artists, comedians, singers, everyone's worried about this, I think. So it'll be a story to watch. The legislation will be very interesting. And we only have a couple minutes left, and I really wanted to get to the Frida Kahlo story. So Frida Kahlo Corporation is suing Amazon vendors for selling images of Frida's likeness and artworks. Okay, so what's going on there? I thought Frida was a communist. How did she become a corporation? And isn't there some point where somebody's image is everywhere already? Why now? How can they do this now?
Yes, so yes, despite Frida's political leanings, the corporation was created. Now, the corporation, the Frida Kahlo Corporation, was established by her niece and also a licensing agent. And it was created to manage the rights to Frida's name, likeness, and image. And the corporation licenses out the images for various products, including apparel, accessories, artwork reproductions. And their stated goal is to protect not only their rights, but to preserve her legacy. Now, the intersection between her communist beliefs and the criminalization of her image through a corporation, I mean, that raises complex questions, right? About, you know, commerce, yeah. Ideology, and art. So even though she may have exposed or may have, you know, wanted to push communist ideals during her lifetime, the criminalization of her image after her death reflects the broader trends in the art world, where sometimes commercial value trumps an artist's legacy and often conflicts with their personal beliefs and their legacies. So at this point, the corporation is doing what they can. And that's the thing with intellectual property rights, is you have to flex them. You have to protect them. And even though, you know, better late than never is a mantra to follow, because if they don't, then it will just continue to run rampant. And, you know, hopefully they set their sights on people who are using her images in a way that would tarnish her legacy, but they don't really have to, because people have a right to their name, their image, and their likeness to right of publicity. And when you file a trademark, you have the right to protect your trademark and protect your brand and protect your logo. So that's what the corporation is doing. And they've taken aim, and this isn't the first time, and it won't be the last time. So, you know, if artists want to protect themselves from getting involved in this type of thing, they should seek licensing agreements when they can. Either that, or they should create art that is transformative and transforms the original use of the art, or parodies it, as long as it doesn't serve as a trademark.
Yeah, that was what, and it is like our last minute, but I did want to, I mean, there is some room for negotiation, I think, too, from artists who then do want to mimic certain other brands. I mean, I know that some brands say, hey, great, that's even more publicity for us, but we'll charge you a licensing fee, or vice versa. So it seems like there's some room there.
Yes, exactly. So overall, I am more on the artist's rights. I represent artists, and I just want artists to protect their artwork before it gets stolen.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. We are out of time. This is Maria Hall. We've been speaking with attorney Eric Seha. In our first segment, we spoke with John Naughty. Thank you so much to our listeners. This is the Lawyers Guild Show signing off. KPFK 90.7 FM. We'll talk to you next week.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that Peter is gold? After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up.
You're listening to KPFA 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the servants, California and beyond.
Support comes from the California Roots Music and Arts Festival, returning Memorial Day weekend to Monterey, California with 3 days stacked with the best in live music, featuring performances by Stick Figure, Revolution, Ice Cube, E-40 and Too Short, Damian Marley, Stephen Marley, and many more. California Roots Music and Arts Festival, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May